The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. It's time to bring out the Better Worldian in all of us. Welcome to Better Worldians Radio with your hosts, Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel. Better Worldians Radio inspires you with the people and ideas that are making the world a better place. You'll hear how small acts can make a big difference every day. Now, here are Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory.
Hi, this is Ray Hansel. Welcome to Better Worldians Radio. Better Worldians Radio is a weekly broadcast whose mission is to uplift and inspire you to make the world a better place. Every week, we are speaking with best-selling authors, film producers, TED speakers, happiness experts, and also everyday folks just like you whose small acts are making a big difference. And that's why we call them Better Worldians. Speaking of Better Worldians, let me now introduce you to my co-hosts Mary Sue Hansel and Gregory Hansel. Mary Sue has been a successful entrepreneur and business executive for over 30 years. She's also an avid practitioner of the healing arts, positive psychology, and spirituality. And now here's my life partner, Mary Sue.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here with you today to share all the good that's being done in the world. Now, let me also introduce Gregory Hansel. Gregory has a background in philosophy and world religions, and most importantly, has spent over 15 years at the intersection of technology, social causes, and big ideas.
Hi, this is Greg. I'm so glad you can all join us here on Better Worldians Radio. Let me first just tell you a bit about my dad, Ray, who you just heard from. He's a serial entrepreneur who successfully founded and with Mary Sue took public a national marketing firm. Giving back has always been really important to Dad, who supports many causes, especially disadvantaged children and their families. By the way, we're the family team that created the popular social game on Facebook called A Better World. It rewards players for doing good deeds while helping to raise money and awareness for charities. To date, over 25 million good deeds have been done in A Better World by more than 2.7 million people. And in the month of February, we're supporting First Book, a nonprofit that provides access to new books for children in need. When our players complete 300,000 good deeds in the game this month, we'll release funds to purchase 400 brand new children's books.
This week on Better Worldians Radio, we're talking with scientist and educator Dr. V.A. Shiva Ayyadurai. Shiva is a renowned scientist, system scientist, and computational systems biology expert. He teaches systems visualization, a pioneering new course at MIT. He's also the founder and executive director of the International Center for Integrative Systems in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's passionate about integrating both Eastern and Western medicines to create a new convergent medicine that is fully consistent with the scientific method. Ayyadurai holds 4 degrees from MIT, including a PhD in systems biology at the Department of Biological Engineering. Hi, Shiva. Thanks so much for joining us today on Better Worldians Radio.
Hello. How are you? Great to be on the show.
You're very, very welcome. We're very excited because you have so much to share with our listeners today, and I think they're very listening to hear all of your story. I'd like to begin your story for our listeners in India, where you witnessed your grandmother practicing healing tradition called Siddha. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, Siddha is the oldest form of traditional medicine that's been documented. It was the original form of medicine that was practiced by the original natives of India, who were called the Dravidians, and is still practiced today. It's a traditional form of medicine because they have a complete system. It has its own language, and it spans the areas of, you know, herbal medicine, the usage of what they call alchemical metals. It includes yoga. It includes martial arts. And it also includes a whole set of yogic techniques. So it's a comprehensive system. And in fact, Ayurveda came out of Siddha. And in fact, we in the United States today, 20 million yoga practitioners. So that's one lineage that can be traced all the way back to Siddha.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Siddha still practiced in India?
Yeah, so Siddha is still practiced in India. In fact, India, at the government level, they have an institute called, it's part of a government ministry called AYUSH, A-Y-U-S-H, which is Ayurveda, Unani, Yoga, Siddha, and Homeopathy. So Siddha is one track. So in India, for example, you can go and get Siddha treatment. In fact, there's a National Institute of Siddha, which was inaugurated by the Prime Minister in 2007. Hmm. So it's definitely practiced today.
Hmm. Now, what did you learn from observing your grandmother?
Well, what I learned from observing my grandmother was her ability to observe.
Okay.
So, you know, most doctors today in Western medicine really don't observe their patients anymore. They use instruments. Mm-hmm. But in the Siddha tradition, it was your power of observation that let you really diagnose the patient. So the observations there included observing the face, for example, observing people's eyes, observing, in fact, urine, observing the skin. But the observations were done visually, sometimes tactily with your hands, smell. Mm-hmm. But the individual used their own powers of observation, and those observations were used by my grandmother to understand the kind of body type of that person. So everyone has a particular body type. And then based on that body type, through those observations, she was able to understand their imbalances. And so, you know, if your body's supposed to be behaving a certain way, you have certain imbalances, mm-hmm. then she would recommend different types of treatments. And they weren't a treatment that one size fits all. So different people got maybe different herbs, different mixtures of herbs, mm-hmm. customized. Some people got different yoga moves to do. Some people got different massage. And some people, in mm-hmm. fact, got different mantras, which are called sound. Mm-hmm. But today in the Western world, you know, we call this personalized medicine, but this was the foundations of Siddha, which she practiced. Mm.
Did that observation take longer than typically what you might find practiced in Western medicine, where this would be a more of a, this observation would take a little bit longer in terms of that transaction between the patient and the practitioner?
Well, I think if you look at it on average, I would say was, you know, I mean, obviously if someone has a gashing wound on them, right? I mean, right. That's a pretty easy thing to observe. They have a wound on them. But right. when you look at measurement and understanding it, I mean, what my grandmother would do, I mean, she would do it very, very quickly because, you know, this is an art and you've built a sensibility over time. Not that different than a mechanic when you bring your car in. Mm-hmm. He doesn't, you know, he has a pretty good idea what's going on by listening to it. Good mm-hmm. mechanics. Mm-hmm. In Western medicine, you know, we spend hours in waiting rooms. We take tons of blood tests. We wait days, weeks. We take MRI images, which are getting faster, right? So you can go right in.
Right.
But it was very quick. I mean, my grandmother is actually a farmer who worked 16-hour days, but on weekends she'd have 20, 30 people lined up, and she would have to do this relatively quickly because not everyone had time. Mm-hmm. So the observations were based on intuition and tons of experiences where intuition comes from.
How do these experiences drive you to pursue science when you move to the United States?
Well, for me, you know, seeing my grandmother use this system, and I think the key word is system, of diagnosis and observation and recommendations, and I empirically seeing people get healed. As a kid, I was fascinated by this, and I wanted to know how she was able to do this. What was the science behind this? And how could I do it? And how could I actually explain it to others, why it works? So it was really a mystery to me. So I think I was inspired and also moved by this fascinating way that this woman with no degrees, who lived in a small village, had tattoos all over her arms, worked 16-hour days, was able to heal people. So that motivation, when we came to the United States, really was the core of my motivation to want to study medicine and understand as much as I could, you mm-hmm. know, science, math, physics, mm-hmm. design, biology, mm-hmm. Really understand why this worked.
Mm-hmm. And so you threw yourself into that. I guess something our listeners don't know is you came to NYU at the ripe old age of 14. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was, I mean, when we came to the United States, you have to understand, we came from what's called a quote-unquote low-caste Indian family, so the opportunities in India were very minimal. So the fact my parents made it here, mm-hmm. the United States, was significant. Mm-hmm. So I was motivated by knowing the fact that my parents, and we came from very, very repressed backgrounds in India. So mm-hmm. coming to the United States was a huge motivator to do very well, and I was very ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I was, 13, 14, I'd finished up all the math courses in my high school and got accepted to a very special program at the Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences at New York University. So, yes, I did have the opportunity to go to NYU at a very early age mm-hmm. and study computer science.
And that further piqued your interest in medical research. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was an interesting transition because I was actually, studying math and computer science at NYU, I always thought would be a vehicle for me to use those skills in medicine. So when I finished that, I wanted to drop out of high school. My mom actually introduced me to the head of the computer center, which is a very small computer center. This is in 1978 at what is now known as Rutgers Medical School. Then it was known as the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. And his name was Dr. Les Michelson, who was a high-energy physicist. And he had set up in the medical school a computing system, typically for scientists to use for data processing.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone remembers, in the 70s, who used computers? It was mm-hmm. highly technical people, mm-hmm. mainly men, mm-hmm. and they used computers for data processing. So when I went to that medical school, I thought he was going to allow me to do medical research mm-hmm. with my computing skills. But he gave me something else to do, which was to create the electronic version of the interoffice mail system, which is what I did as a project, and I called it email. I named it email, a term that had never been used before, and I defined email as we all know and use today. After I did that, I got the opportunity to actually to do some medical research because I'd sort of proved my chops,
mm-hmm.
Which was to look at sleep patterns of babies. At that time, this medical school, one of the researchers there had some of the best data on how babies were sleeping and how they were also dying. It's a disease called sudden infant death syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was, could I create, use my computing and math skills to create an algorithm that could understand the sleep patterns of babies to predict the onset of these apneas, which caused a sudden, heart attack or breathing stoppage.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a short break for our listeners, but before we go, I just want to take a moment to congratulate the players in our social game on Facebook for reaching their charity goal of the month in January. And because they did 300,000 good deeds in the game, we're releasing funds to Integral Heart Foundation in Guatemala to sponsor 60 students and to provide food for their families. We're going to take a short break right now, but we'll talk more with Dr. Shiva Iyadhara when we come back.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
In 1987, some inner-city first graders were promised a college education. Now, this promise didn't come from a wealthy corporation. It came from Oral Lee Brown, who saved a large portion of her modest income every year for these children.
She told Ms. Brown, you can't do everything I said, no, but we need to do more.
And she did more by sending 19 kids to college, helping others. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
How can we make it a better world?
I think we can make it a better world if we had peace among each other.
Everybody needs to help their neighbor, and then it will spread from then on.
I should do more.
I could do more. I spend so much time on Facebook.
How much time do I spend on Facebook?
Probably more than I should be spending.
I would definitely get back if I could find the time.
Now you can help others just by playing a game on Facebook. It's called A Better World. Share your hopes and dreams. Do good deeds. Make a difference. And have fun. Become a better worldian. Join a community where all good deeds get rewarded. Log in today to find out how you can make a difference every day.
For more information, visit facebook.com/a better world.
I've always wanted a neighbor just like you.
I've always wanted to live
in a neighborhood with you.
So let's make the most of this beautiful day.
Since we're together, we might as well say,
would you be mine?
Could you be mine?
Won't you be my neighbor?
My neighbor?
Mr. Rogers passed along friendship in his neighborhood, hoping we would do the same. So let's get started. Friendship. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
She didn't just visit the sick and poor. She moved in with them. It wasn't convenient, and it wasn't pretty, but they needed help. 12 more then joined this saint of the gutters. They were soon followed by over 4,000 other nuns who gave healing care in orphanages, AIDS hospices, and charity centers. Mother Teresa couldn't do it all, but she gave her all. Compassion. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
Streaming live. The leader in internet talk radio. VoiceAmerica.com.
This is Better Worldians Radio with a family team of Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel. To connect with the show today, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send us an email to radio@betterworldians.com. Now, back to Better Worldians Radio.
You're listening to Better Worldians Radio. We're speaking with scientist and educator Dr. V.A. Shiva Iyadhara.
Hi, Shiva. This is Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good, Greg. How are you?
Great, great. So I know you did hint at this a few minutes ago in the first segment, but tell us, how does Eastern medicine typically differ from Western?
Well, Eastern medicine and Western medicine, in my opinion, differ in a very fundamental way. Western medicine, if you trace the history of it, fundamentally came from war.
Mm.
Modern healthcare, Western medicine, came from war. It was, and you can trace it back to, you know, Florence Nightingale, who was not just a nurse, but she was the founder of modern healthcare.
Mm.
And the idea was soldiers were dying on the field, and was how do you get them back on the field? And they were dying, in fact, of wounds, not because of the wounds that were not be able to be taken care of in the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So Western medicine really came out of addressing that need, which was to get the, quote-unquote, the soldier back on the field. So it developed great things like antibiotics and steroids and amazing surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Basically for crisis management.
Right.
Eastern medicine, on the other hand, was a completely different system. Its requirements were very different, which was based on civilian use, people living in indigenous world, and how do you maintain and preserve and prevent, catastrophic situations. So it was actually a very different requirement. And so out of that, you had modalities which was primarily based on diet, learning how to live in synergy with the environment, with the ecosystem, et cetera. So the whole basis of Eastern medicine was, some people call it holistic, but I call it basically they were fundamentally different systems. Eastern medicine systems requirements were prevention,
mm-hmm.
maintenance of health for the civilian environment. Western medicine was really coming out of war and reaction and crisis-minded. So those are the fundamental differences that I've been able to sort of best articulate.
Well, that's interesting. What do you see as the benefits of integrating both Eastern and Western medicine then?
Well, if you think about the spectrum of someone's disease, right, there are manifestations of disease that you don't even see. And then there's manifestations which are full-blown. So if you think about someone getting cancer, in the Eastern system of medicine, there are really six stages to every disease. Very early onset, going, you know, up through the sixth stage where you see the full-blown disease, like a tumor showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Western medicine is really good in that latter stages, you know, after, everything has gone bad. Then you come in and then you try to use chemotherapy or you try to go do surgery. It's really good for that latter half. Eastern medicine is really for that first part where you're diagnosing things, you're seeing phenomenon that are occurring long before they manifest themselves into full-blown disease, and you want to address those early. So,
mm-hmm.
again, you know, integrating both, lets us, A, do prevention, and B, for those people who already have stuff, we need to go take care of them
mm-hmm.
because they're in a crisis and then put them on prevention. So that's the way we can integrate both. And there's a benefit to both if we're able to train doctors and medical professionals to handle that spectrum.
So what are some of the challenges of that integration?
The biggest challenge is attitudinal and, frankly, some level of ignorance on both sides.
Right.
So that's really the challenge. So in the Western world, you know, people typically go through a reductionist training.
Sure.
Reductionism meaning you don't see the body as a system. You see it, engineers do, medical doctors don't. Mm-hmm. Medical training is looking at it as parts. So you have, an ache in your ankle bone, you go fix that. You don't realize the ankle bone's connected to the foot bone, et cetera. So the challenges are, retraining Western professionals to have this system holistic approach. And part of that challenge is when they hear the Eastern, you know, what some people call the woo-woo words, right? Fire, earth, metal,
right.
Meditation, yoga, right?
Mm-hmm.
Asanas, karma, dharma. They sort of get freaked out a little bit because these are words that they're not used to. They're used to the words genes, molecules, etc. The flip side, the Eastern world is very much based on intuition, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they use a language which is, frankly, as I'll speak about later, founded in science, but they're not able to communicate that to the modern Western world. And that challenge has posed itself where some of the Eastern stuff has become religious,
right.
Guru worship, personality-based.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the key challenges.
Well, that's interesting. So I know there's some implications regarding DNA and genes in your work, and they go toward how you're solving some of these challenges, or at least responding to them. But could you start by explaining the big difference between DNA and genes?
Sure. So if you think about it, genes in the traditional Watson-Crick model, which was called the central dogma theory, genes, which are sets of sequences in the DNA, give rise, they're like the blueprint which give rise to particular proteins, and those proteins manifest themselves in particular features in your body. So DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, which is the actual molecule.
Mm-hmm.
DNA is billions of what are called base pairs, but it's actually a molecule. It's a double helix, looks like a ladder. Everyone has seen it, a helix, in every cell in your body. So DNA is the actual physical chemical molecule.
Mm-hmm.
Portions of that DNA, you know, could be several base pairs, hundreds of base pairs, thousands, code for particular genes. And those genes manifest self in what are called phenotypes, which are features. So, for example, if you have blue eyes and someone else, say your wife has brown eyes, there's a gene which codes for eye color.
Mm-hmm.
That gene is expressed physically by a set of chemical sequences along that DNA molecule. So DNA is a molecule. Genes are one level up, which are aggregates of that molecule which express a particular feature.
Hmm. Well, you know, I read a really interesting anecdote you wrote about identical twins. And could you talk about how the difference between genes and DNA might explain why identical twins are not always, well, identical?
Yeah, it's a great question. Up until 2000, mm-hmm. and it's very recent, I mean, in relative to genetic history, going back to the 50s, the theory was called the central dogma theory, as I said earlier, but the central dogma theory was a religion in some sense that said you are your genes. You know, you have eye color for XYZ genes, you know, you're going to definitely have that. Or you have this gene for this disease, you're definitely going to get that disease. However, when the Genome Project ended around 2000, they noticed that we actually have the same number of genes as a worm. We have about 20,000 genes. We don't have more genes than a worm. So it really led to this whole field called epigenetics, realizing maybe it's not just the genes that make us who we are, but it's the complexity of all the molecular reactions, because human beings probably have more complexity in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what ended up happening was they did some very interesting research with where they found twins, or more interestingly, even in mice, where they've taken two sets of mice,
mm-hmm.
one which was bred to be aggressive, so they had the gene for aggression, and another set of mice which had the genes for, let's say, being passive. And they took the mice from an aggressive gene's mother and had it nursed by a passive gene's mother. Well, that mice grows up, and it turns out that mice is not at all aggressive, even though it's the aggressive genes, because the pacific mice or the passive mice actually lick their pups when they're growing. And that licking turns on a whole bunch of genes which turn off the aggressive behavior. So the point is, what we're realizing is that even if you take identical twins, let's say they both have the genes for blue eyes or some feature, based on the environmental conditions, you can actually turn on and turn off genes.
Right.
And that's called epigenetics.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it really does underline that importance of not just the genes, but the relationship between the genes and the relationship between them and the environment. And that gets at some of your work with systems health. Now, I know we want to talk in depth about systems health, but could you begin by just saying to the listeners, what is a system in the way that you mean it? And what is systems health?
Yeah, so what is a system? We use that word a lot. A system is an interconnected set of parts, and the thing that comes out of that interconnection of those parts, a system, is bigger than the parts themselves, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it, if I gave you, a wheel, some gears, and some metal in a box, one person could put that together to create a tricycle. Someone else could make a bicycle, and someone else could make a unicycle.
Mm-hmm.
Three very different systems, all composed of the same parts, but they're interconnected differently. So the key to a system is not the parts alone, but the interconnections among those parts. That's what foundations of systems theory, that what emerges, keyword is emerges, out of the interconnection of those parts
mm-hmm.
is bigger than the individual parts themselves. So that's what a system is. It's an interconnection of parts and the emergent property that comes out of that.
Mm. So tell us about systems health then.
So I, as I shared earlier, you know, as a six-year-old kid watching my grandmother use this system of Indian medicine, I was really moved to understand why this worked. Well, about 40 years of research, 4 degrees at MIT, and then going back to India on a Fulbright, I cracked the code on really understanding why my grandmother was able to heal people, and more importantly, the system of Siddha and Ayurveda, what they were
mm-hmm.
and why it works. So if you study Chinese medicine or Indian medicine,
mm-hmm.
they will use a whole language, Vata, Pitta, Kapha. Some of you may have heard of this in Ayurveda, or fire, earth, mm-hmm. metal, water, wood in Chinese medicine. And these words, when we in the West look at them, we think, oh, this must be hocus pocus. These people are just doing magic.
Mm-hmm.
But systems theory, which in the Western world came out in the 1930s, really founded by American systems theorists,
mm-hmm.
in control systems engineering, they came up with a whole new language that became the foundations of modern engineering systems. So every airplane, for example, has an autopilot today. Every house has a thermostat. Well, the functionality of devices like that are founded in systems theory, in fact, called control systems engineering.
Right.
And there's probably about 7 principles which govern those systems. And what I was able to do is I was able to find a one-to-one correlation between what we call modern engineering theory
mm-hmm.
and directly with Siddha.
Hmm.
One-to-one. It was like a Rosetta Stone. And that was a basis of me creating systems health, which is really the future of medicine, in my opinion, because systems health links together ancient medicine grounded in scientific foundation and makes it accessible to the Western world. So systems health is really the future of medicine.
I think that's fascinating. You know, it's interesting that you brought up the American systems theorists because, you know, not to get too wonky for the listeners, but I know that in the East, for example, in India, there's the notion of interdependent co-arising, Pratitya Samutpada, and things like that. Were those influences for you as well?
Yeah, I think you're referring to like Indian yogic theory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you look at the entire Indian lingua franca
mm-hmm.
of Siddha, you know, there's a whole language that they use to describe the world. And they use a word called, for example, prakriti,
mm-hmm.
which is unmanifest energy, which gives rise to purusha, which is everything we see around us. That gives rise to the subtle energy, sattvic, tamasic, rajasic. That then gives rise to the doshas.
Mm-hmm.
That gives rise to the elements, which gives rise to the doshas. Bottom line is they have a whole language that they use to describe their world. Systems health actually has been is the Rosetta Stone, or the thesaurus, which helps you, which helps us understand that.
We're going to take another break right now. For our fans and our listeners out there, if you haven't checked out this social enterprise called A Better World, you might find it very interesting. Its mission is to uplift and brighten the world. And the goal with the actual social virtual world and everything we do is to do good, have fun, and to change the world in the process. We're committed to creating some awesome digital products designed with the purpose of making a difference through optimism, altruism, and charity. You can find out more at abetterworld.com. In the meantime, we'll be right back.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
She didn't just visit the sick and poor. She moved in with them. It wasn't convenient, and it wasn't pretty, but they needed help. 12 more then joined this saint of the gutters. They were soon followed by over 4,000 other nuns who gave healing care in orphanages, AIDS hospices, and charity centers. Mother Teresa couldn't do it all, but she gave her all. Compassion. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
I've always wanted a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live
in a neighborhood with you.
So let's make the most of this beautiful day.
Since we're together, we might as well say,
would you be mine?
Could you be mine?
Won't you be my neighbor?
My neighbor?
Mr. Rogers passed along friendship in his neighborhood, hoping we would do the same. So let's get started. Friendship. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
How can we make it a better world?
I think we can make it a better world if we had peace among each other.
Everybody needs to help their neighbor, and then it will spread from then on.
I should do more.
I could do more. I spend so much time on Facebook.
How much time do I spend on Facebook?
Probably more than I should be spending.
I would definitely get back if I could find the time.
Now you can help others just by playing a game on Facebook. It's called A Better World. Share your hopes and dreams. Do good deeds. Make a difference. And have fun. Become a Better Worldian. Join a community where all good deeds get rewarded. Log in today to find out how you can make a difference every day.
For more information, visit facebook.com/abetterworld.
In 1987, some inner-city first graders were promised a college education. Now, this promise didn't come from a wealthy corporation. It came from Oral Lee Brown, who saved a large portion of her modest income every year for these children.
She told Ms. Brown, you can't do everything. I said, no, but we need to do more.
And she did more by sending 19 kids to college, helping others. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
This is Better Worldians Radio with a family team of Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel. To connect with the show today, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send us an email to radio@betterworldians.com. Now, back to Better Worldians Radio.
We're back now with Dr. V.A. Shiva Iadora. Now let's welcome back Shiva and Mary Sue.
Hi, Shiva.
How are you, Mary Sue?
Very good. Can you talk a bit about the study of herbs, your study of herbs and supplements, and how it relates to systems health?
Sure. You know, in the Indian tradition or the Chinese tradition, herbs all had properties. And those properties were defined by a language that we may find foreign to us. Sometimes they called herbs heating or cooling, or herbs were called of a particular taste. But they characterized herbs using a certain language that may seem very simple to us, but they were property-based terms to identify these herbs. In the Western world, you know, we look at herbs and we try to break them down into constitutive ingredients. So if you take something like turmeric, you know, it is broken down into various curcuminoids. Or if you take cannabis, which is broken down into THC or CBDs or terpenoids. So in the Western world, we take an herb and we break it down into ingredients, and then we try to find an active ingredient and try to understand what that is. In the Eastern world, they looked at the herb as an whole, and they had properties that described that whole in a language that may be foreign to us. So my study of herbs and supplements has been, how do you interconnect the Eastern approach, which is this holistic approach to understanding that herb, and the Western approach, which understands the herb or supplement at the biological level, and how do you integrate that together so we can have a systems view, not just a holistic or reductionist, but a systems view to understand the value of that herb to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned turmeric, and you call it a wonder drug. Why do you say that? What are the benefits?
Well, you know, turmeric is interesting. The reason I called it a wonder drug is that, you know, the number one cause of death in Asia, in the U.S., as many of you know, it's heart disease. In Asia, it is liver cancer. In Asia, we mean China, Mongolia, you know, India, Indonesia, et cetera. But when epidemiological studies were conducted, it was found that Indians have one-third less liver cancer across all of Asia. And those epidemiological studies traced it down to the food that Indians were eating, which primarily included curry. Curry is really a mixture of spices, but one of the active ingredients in curry, one of the herbs, is called turmeric. Hmm. And in fact, Indians have a very low amount of dementia, very low amount of, you know, inflammation, and many people believe inflammation is the foundations of both cancer as well as a host of other diseases. So turmeric, I consider it a wonder drug because the more and more research is coming out how it helps, you know, modulate or lower inflammation, how it is a, you know, anti-carcinogen, how it is a neuroprotective. It helps in so many ways. That's why I call it a wonder drug.
Wow, it sounds like I should be taking it.
Well, yeah, now it's an important thing. How, you know, when we call it a drug, remember I said turmeric was used in curry.
Right.
So it's important when people take it, they actually take it in the right mixture instead of just taking a bunch of turmeric by itself.
I see. You mean with food?
With food and mix it with pepper, mix it with other herbs. So in India, every village had a curry. Every family had their own curry. And essentially, in my view, the curry was a personalized medicine. So in a curry, they had turmeric, they had coriander, they had ginger, they had cardamom. Curry, turmeric being getting most of its yellow color, or curry getting its yellow color from turmeric. But yeah, it was a mixture of herbs, and the reason they mixed it was then you increase the bioavailability in Western terms of that turmeric. For example, pepper increases the availability of turmeric so your body can absorb it better.
Very interesting. Now, how about ginger? That's another one we hear a lot about, and I think you've mentioned that in your white paper, that it's a great anti-inflammatory. How does that work?
Yeah, so ginger, you know, from the Western perspective has, you know, has what are called chemicals known as gingerols. And there's a whole host of Western research showing that it's an anti-inflammatory. It also, you know, one of the great things that it's good for is if you ever have, you know, inflammation in the bowels or stomach upset. Hmm. And if anyone's ever having any type of, your stomach's not doing good, believe it or not, ginger ale is very good. If you can't get anything and you can't get access to ginger root and you can get access to some ginger ale, it's very, very valuable. So ginger is a phenomenal anti-inflammatory. And, you know, at home, for example, we make ginger tea almost every day. And but you have to remember, when you use ginger, you should always shave the skin off, especially if it's raw ginger root. And then you cut it into slices, and you can put it in hot water and tea and drink it. Dry ginger has a very different effect. You know, it's more used within teas. In India, they call it chukku. But it also has a similar effect, but it has a much more heating effect.
Yeah, that's interesting. My grandmother always gave us ginger ale when we were sick. So there you go.
There's a reason for that. Right? She knew what she was doing.
Right. And now how about the benefits of ginseng and something called ashwagandha? Is that how to say it?
Ashwagandha.
Ashwagandha, okay.
So, you know, there are two herbs. So there's two classes of herbs. You know, there are herbs which have immediate effect or even – so think about caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to take a cup of coffee, you get wired pretty immediately, right?
Right.
Same thing if you take certain ingredients, you feel the immediate effect. Many of those are called stimulants. There are other herbs which are called adaptogens.
Mm-hmm.
Adaptogens meaning that they have – effect on your body over time. They adapt to your body. Ginseng and ashwagandha are such herbs. Ginseng is sort of the Indian ashwagandha, or ashwagandha is the Indian ginseng. It's like the Indian ashwagandha, and ashwagandha is like the Chinese ginseng.
Wow.
In fact, everyone thinks ginseng is with China. In fact, some of the best ginseng is actually American ginseng, believe it or not.
Oh.
But ginseng, the benefits of ginseng and ashwagandha, they strengthen the body, according to research. They are also have tremendous anabolic effects, anti-aging, so for example, building muscle, and, you know, benefits in sexual health. So they actually support the upregulation, it's thought of, and modulation of certain hormones as you age, which get depleted. And you can find both these herbs today in some reasonably good health food stores. But again, most of the issues with herbs are that wherever you find it, you want to make sure is the quality good,
yeah.
You know, where it's the source of it, because the ingredients, which Western science is great at showing, can vary significantly on where the ashwagandha was grown, when it was picked, same with ginseng. So quality is going to become more and more important. So your question, where can people find it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can find it at Whole Foods, but where is Whole Foods getting it from?
Exactly. Now, here's one I've never heard of, snake root.
Yeah, so snake root, believe it or not, was the first herb that Western scientists truly studied sort of in the 20s, meaning like, today we study many, many herbs. Western science is going after many herbs, but snake root was one of the first herbs Western science was very fascinated by because it's an alkaloid. The Indian word for sarpaganda, which means snake root, and some people call it a word that's associated with chandra, which is a moon. So the folklore goes that snake root, when people had lunacy, quote-unquote, when the moon
right.
came out,
uh-huh.
that they would use snake root to calm them down. In fact, Gandhi used to chew it because it calms you down. It has an alkaloid property. So Western psychopharmacists were interested in this because they took an active ingredient out of there called reseperine, which was used to make some of the early pharmaceutical drugs for psychiatric disorders. So snake root is a calming herb. Again, if you take too much of it, you may get depressed. So all of these herbs have a homeostasis. You want to take the right amount. If you take too much of it, it'll calm you too much, which leads to depression.
Mm. Very good. Now, you recommend yoga as part of your health system, and I can tell from that's something that your grandmother used. But what do you say are the benefits? What are the scientific proven benefits of yoga?
Well, you know, first of all, we have to understand what is yoga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yoga, first of all, we think, you know, it's doing these poses. So when we say I recommend yoga for health, what is yoga? So yoga is not just the poses.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually multiple branches of yoga. One of the first branches of yoga was being a good human being and being serving others. In fact, in the traditional yogic system, you weren't even taught meditation. You weren't taught any of the asanas until you learned to serve, which means serving other people, learning how to live a disciplined life, learning how to be a caring human being. Once you prove those to a teacher, then you were ready to learn yoga, which was meditation and what we today call asanas. And obviously the benefits of the yogic system were intended to make someone who was a empathetic, kind human being at the highest level, not just to, you know, bend and flex and those kind of things, which obviously have their value, right? Because you
right.
get flexibility, you get strength,
sure.
et cetera. So those are the material benefits. But the larger benefits for health, not only personal health, but for systems health, you know, was how do you live in an ecosystem of being a good human being? So the benefits of yoga, that's what they were for.
Yeah, I think that's a good foundation, teaching people to be good human beings before you do anything. And you mentioned that meditation is also a branch of yoga. Do you recommend any specific type of meditation? Because I know there's many different types.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, when we look at, again, systems health, again, in the traditional, when you look at these yogis, if you remove the concept of them being, you know, these sort of seers or religious people, they were basically system scientists of the ancient times.
Hmm.
And they would look at your body type, which was a system, and they would recommend particular medicines for you, meditation being a particular type of medicine. So not everyone was supposed to do the same type of meditation.
Oh.
So someone was very depressed, you know, for example, there's certain types of mantra meditation that they should not do because it could drive them into more depression. If someone was very active and very hyper, obviously certain types of mantra meditation, observing the breath, which was calming, was good for them. So the point is that different types of meditation are intended for different types of body types. So in the United States, for example, when Maharishi came here, he brought in a lot of wealth from India. He grew this thing called TM, which was fundamentally mantra meditation,
right?
Which is repeating a word. There's different other types of meditation where you can concentrate on the breath or observe the sensations, Vipassana or Anapana meditation, or Kundalini, where you observe the base chakra in the body. Bottom line is there's literally seven or X different types of meditation, and they're all intended for different parts of the body based on your system state. So I would not make any global recommendations for people, but except to say there are different types of meditation. There's active meditation, for example, listening to music, some people call dynamic meditation. That's good for people who are a little more depressed and want to get a little more active. On the other extreme, people are highly hyper. They're probably better off sitting, mantra meditation, or sleep, or observing the breath sensations.
Very, very informative. How about acupuncture? How does that fit into the whole system health?
So, it's a great question. Recent, you know, in the Indian and Chinese system, they recognized that there was energy movement through the body, and energy meaning whatever you want to call it, electricity, magnetism, fluid, flow, mechanical, but there was an energy system to the body.
Mm-hmm.
In the Western world, we understood the muscular system. We understood the nervous system. In the Indian system, they called it nadis. In the Chinese system, they call it meridians. And in systems health, what we've been able to do is we've been able to understand that those acupuncture points, where are points that an acupuncturist goes and manipulates, are related to moving energy through the body. What we've done with systems health is we've actually have an explanation to actually understand what are those acupuncture points, what are the nadis, what are the meridians. And our theory that's unfolding is they're not part of the nerves, they're not part of the muscle system, they're actually part of the fascia system. And it's a longer discussion, but systems health is basically uncovering that that fascial system maps one-to-one with the nadis and meridians, which is the parts of our body which are actually made up of a crystalline material called piezoelectric crystals, which are founded by collagen. But systems health is really bridging our understanding of what that meridian system is.
Good. Can you explain what personalized medicine is and how you foresee it working in the future?
Sure. Personalized medicine is what my grandmother used to do. So if you look at ancient systems of medicine, people have been practicing it for thousands of years. We're basically coming to rediscover that one size does not fit all.
Mm.
And, you know, that At the genetic level, we're different, but in the Indian level, everyone's got a different body type. And the future of this is that in the future, when you go to get healing, it's going to be based on you, not based on how much I can sell you, right?
Right.
So it's going to be based on you and figuring out the right herbs or supplements or exercise or massage that's right for you. So it's basically going full circle and coming back to what my grandmother used to do or what Indian medicine used to do.
Well, how do you see them doing that? Is that through your blood or your genes or your DNA?
Yeah, it's a good question. So right now, the way Western medicine is moving is they're going to try to understand your genomic sequence, right? And based on your genome, then they're going to say, okay, for these genes, then you need this. But in my view, that's only going to get half the puzzle of personalized medicine. What we need to do is not only understand people's genes, but we also need to understand the environment people live in, right? So if you're living in a very stressed world and you have the best genes, mm-hmm. you're going to have to manipulate someone's inputs based on that. And I think the future of that is really systems health, because we've really integrated East and West to do that. So you can't do personalized medicine just using the Western genetic profile. You have to use that. And you have to use the Western approach and Eastern approach.
You know, I see that you're offering a course called the Systems Health Course. Now, is that something for lay people or just medical people? And is it about everything that we've been discussing over the last hour?
Yes, Systems Health was designed for anyone. Obviously, medical professionals can take it. Healthcare practitioners can take it, from naturopaths, acupuncturists, chiropractors, and individuals. When I designed this course in 2007, after sort of cracking this code on integrating Eastern and Western medicine, I originally offered it at MIT, and we did it as a lecture series. 200 people would show up on a Thursday night. Now, who was in that audience? Well, it was MDs. It was PhDs. It was researchers, one half. The other group of people were ordinary people who had an interest in health, feeling better, yoga practitioners, etc. So Systems Health, the bottom line is we designed that course so it would bridge this elitism, which tends to face the healthcare industry, be it on the Western side or the Eastern side. The idea was to create a language and a way of understanding health using a systems approach that was accessible to everyone and to really break barriers. And if people want to learn more about that course, we have a website, systemshealth.com. And on that course, you can take individual courses. We actually have a practitioner's training, all done online at the convenience of anyone's home. And then based on that, they can actually get tools, which we give away for free, that they can use to educate others and even assess others' health.
Well, I'll have to personally look into that.
Shiva, we need to wrap up in just a minute, but I want to ask the question that we always ask our guest on every program, and that is, how do you hope that the work that you're doing can help make the world a better place?
Well, fundamentally, everything I've done is, not new. It's basically integrating ancient wisdom that indigenous people had. Indigenous people lived in concert with the universe, which means they lived in a sustainable way, in small local collectives, solving problems to help civilians in a civilian manner, not for war. So I see Systems Health as bridging the worlds of East and West, ancient and modern, and science and tradition, to bring us all back to true health, which is really reconnecting back with our ancestors who actually lived with harmony with the earth. So that's what Systems Health is about, and that's the only future all of us have, because the current model of where we're going is not going to make the world a better place, but we need to learn from ancient wisdom. And that's what Systems Health does. Systems Health takes ancient wisdom and modernizes it so we can all accept it, and it's articulated in a way that it hits our Western mindset.
That's been a wonderful experience really going through this with you. You're doing amazing work. You're what many of us call a true better worldian. So for our listeners, you can find out more about Shiva's work by going to vashiva.com. And once again, Shiva, thank you very much for joining us today on Better Worldians Radio.
You're welcome. Great being here.
You're very, very welcome. For our listeners, we want to let you know that next month, Better Worldians Radio and A Better World Game on Facebook will be supporting Fran Drescher's Cancer Schmancer. We will be providing cancer screenings to women in need. As we end our show each week, we like to share our Better Worldians mission here. We strive to make the world a better place by encouraging the very best in everyone. We focus on positive thinking, positive values, and positive actions. In short, our vision is to bring out the better world in everyone so that we can all make it a better world. In the meantime, until next time, please be a better world.
Thank you again for helping make the world just a little bit better this week. Please join your hosts, Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel next Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel. We hope we've inspired you to do one small thing to help make a big difference. Join us at BetterWorldians.com to tell us what you've done to change the world. Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit VoiceAmericaVariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.